I'm Bob Franklin. Thanks for joining me. This is Like It Is. Today, the conclusion of my encore interview with Joe Taylor, former Hampton University head football coach and 2019 College Football Hall of Fame inductee. Coach Taylor is a member of the Black Coaches Association. We resume our conversation from last week on the topic, the lack of African-American football coaches at Division I universities. Coach Taylor joined me via telephone from his office at Hampton University. I asked Coach Taylor if he thought Eddie Robinson, the former legendary coach, football coach at Grambling State College in Louisiana, would have made a good head football coach in professional football.
Oh, without a doubt. Because otherwise, the players that he put there would not have succeeded. It's X and O don't change. It's the relationships, it's the ability to handle people. Because, Eddie was interviewed several times by Los Angeles.
I think I remember hearing the owner of the Los Angeles Rams, I think it may have been, I don't know if it was Rosenblum at that time, but saying that they would interview Eddie Robinson, but they would not hire him. That basically, they were interested in interviewing him, but they didn't see him to be their coach.
Okay. Well, I just riding in the car with them, I don't know how many different times with the games and banquets and whatever. From what he said to me was that he had turned down at that time an assistant area with the Los Angeles Rams, and he just felt like he could do more in terms of, helping his own by, making sure that he was preparing them to go forward rather than being the pros and just deal with the few that came. And that was just his position on it. But to answer your question, I think he would have done an outstanding job and would have been just as successful there as he was at Grambling.
Now, I'd also like for you to keep on your magical crystal ball there and keep looking into your magical crystal ball and tell me, what makes an average coach, what makes a good coach, and what makes a great coach from your perspective?
Okay, good, average, and outstanding is what you're asking, right?
Yes.
Well, as I said before, I think in any discipline or any profession, it all starts with a knowledge base. It's important to know your profession, whether you're a coach, whether you're a doctor, whether you're a lawyer. You must know your profession. And then from there, it's important to be able to relay or transfer your knowledge. In other words, your communication skills. In fact, Eddie used to always say, what is the most important area on a football field? And someone would probably say, the red zone when you're about to score. And some might say when you're backed up on a -3 and you got 97 yards to go. And Eddie used to always say, it's the area between the two ears of the players on the field. So in other words, it's not so much, it's what you know, but it's more important as to what you know being transferred to those who have to do it, being a good communicator. And then the ability to sell your program and, being able to deal with the media. I've seen a lot of outstanding coaches not keep jobs because they didn't have the ability to, and I don't want to use the word control, but I don't want to use the word manipulate, but you got to be able to communicate with the media because they are very influential. And you in this community, it's important that you project the right image, that you are doing the right things and that you are representing the mission of that campus. And the NC2A. So, you can have the knowledge base but not have the marketing skills. You can have the marketing skills, but you're short on the, on that knowledge base. Or you can have, most of the great coaches you always hear that they are players' coaches. In other words, being able to communicate and motivate and get your philosophy and your X and O into those players so that they go out there and they play hard for you. So to have all three, I think, makes you great. To have just two of those probably make you, you know, good. Maybe one of those, I don't know if you're going to ever get to average, because I don't know if you just average, I just don't think you stay around long enough to even fall into a category.
And Coach, I didn't hear you say winning. How important is winning to being either a great coach, a good coach, or an average coach? Does winning have anything to do with being a great, good, or average coach?
Well, I never believed in putting the cart before the horse. If you have all three of those areas that I talked about and that makes you great, it's obvious that you are winning. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because you can't win without it.
I'd like to know, does politics have a role in athletics anyway, whatsoever? Political influence in terms of trying to bring about change in athletics, collegiate athletics, I'm referring.
Okay, well, let's go back to my initial statements there about who makes decisions on who's being hired, and maybe we shouldn't look at the NC2A as being the corporate. Whenever you have outstanding alumnus, all right, and I say outstanding, say if they are, I know of an incident, and I probably shouldn't even mention it, but at Texas A&M this past year, R.C. Slocum was let go. And I understand that, you know, the administration on the campus was approached by an alumnus who was very capable of giving the school quite a large sum of money. And in so him offering, the school accepted. But the money was going to be given with the idea that this coach would be let go. And to me, that's the highest form of politics. You know, it's the people, you know, the presidents run the school, but they have bosses. And the bosses, sometimes people say they might be the trustees. But money is power. And I think that's what politics starts and stops, with power and with money. And the more money you have, the bigger your voice. Is that good? No way at all. I think it's horrible. But that's our society. So usually it's people that we have no idea of who it is that's really running the campus. And that, to me, is where the politics start.
But a university certainly can be as great as it wants to be, but it cannot survive without financial support, correct?
Exactly.
And coaches' salaries are paid by certainly support from alumni and friends and business and corporate support and the like.
Right.
So are you saying that there needs to be a balancing of the financial influence and the political influence in terms of decisions that are made about coaches and whether or not they stay at an institution?
And which would be what you might call a perfect world if that happens. I just think it's important that, you know, when we talk about the comfort level, when we talk about the financial givings, when we talk about the coach's ability to communicate to the media, you know, what is he bringing? You look at Coach K at Duke. I don't think there's probably an alumnus from Duke that could approach anybody and have him fired. So, you know, the balance comes from, I think, what you bring to the school. You know, and what kind of winning is going on. And, you know, we used that word earlier, explain what that meant. And again, you know, when you're doing all those things, I think you create your own balance. But whenever you leave room because there might be some concern about your way, you know, your way of handling the media, your way of handling boosters, you know, how much is your program you know, how is it, you know, if you got players downtown creating embarrassment to the school, they're out of control, they're not graduating, you know, now you're opening up for the political side to be more powerful. But I think the balance comes from they're putting money into your program and they are satisfied with the product. And once that's there, I think that's the only way a balance can probably come.
Now, I want to go to the professional league now and would like to ask you, do you think the National Football League, is setting a good example for the hiring of qualified African-American candidates, coaches?
From my own personal standpoint, I would have to say no. Even though I know a lot of outstanding persons who are in the front offices at the NFL with Gene Washington. And I mean, they got a lot of different programs, and they're getting better, you know, and I say that with all sincerity. But those big-time owners, you know, they're just not going to be told, you know, how to run their ship. And, I mean, they worked hard to get to be where they are, to be able to buy an organization. And usually it's a 80 or 90-year family investment, and they just not going to hear it. But they are finding, because when you go from a Dungy to an Edwards, you know, it's been proven that it can be done, but I don't think you can push those people. I mean, they're just too powerful.
So do you think that as powerful as these owners are, as you described, do you think they should be socially conscious, or whether or not that has anything to do with the running of their business?
No, they're not interested in that. But sure, it's been brought to their attention. And again, I think you're going to see it getting better, but that's not why they bought that organization. That's not what drives them. You know, it's all about money, you know, and it's unfortunate, but, you know, greed begets greed. And they're not concerned about the social ills, because they really don't have to, because they just buy what they want. And if if money came by, they normally don't want it.
Well, let me maybe paint an analogy. There are million-dollar superstars who sometimes flaunt, you know, their wealth and through their arrogance and what have you. And some of the critics say of these million-dollar, multi-million-dollar athletes that they owe something to the game, even though they've prospered from the game. Do you think that owners owe anything to the game in terms of addressing an issue, even though they are certainly above reproach financially? Do you think they owe anything to the game?
Oh, personally, I feel that they should. I'm just saying that they don't. But really, I don't, you know, yes, they do owe. And, you know, there are some who, in fact, I find out the older people get, the nicer that they become too, because they want to get right with the Lord before they meet him. So, you know, as they get older, they begin to look back at their years and maybe where they know that they haven't been as sensitive or compassionate, or they didn't have a humanistic side to them because they were so busy building their dynasties. But do they owe back? Oh, yes, because if it had not been for mankind, they wouldn't be where they are. But usually people at that level I'm just talking from a philosophical standpoint, and I'm not condoning it. I'm just simply saying that's just the way it is. And it's not right. But, you know, again, those people, they live beyond what you and I see as the right way to live.
And in coaching, just like in any other business, you're going to hire the best person for your particular team or your business. And if that person isn't getting the job done, you're just going to fire them and move on and find someone who can, correct?
Well, it happened in Detroit just last week. You know, the guy was told after the season that the job was still his. And then when another guy becomes available, they just fire the guy and just pay the next guy $25 million. That's just their world. And, I mean, in fact, they didn't even consider the new order put in place in conjunction with the BCA and Johnny Cochran.
Explain that for our listeners, what you were describing. Explain that plan.
Well, you know, we at least we want the interview. Even if the job is not given, we just feel that out of every job that if you interview, four or five, at least one of two African Americans should be interviewed. And we even tried at the college level under the leadership of, the Minority Issues Committee at the college level that out of every four jobs, an African American should be given one. And I said should be given. In other words, a qualified African American out of every four to five jobs that opens in Division One, it should go to an African American. Those are some of the initiatives that are going on. But Cochran and, of course, the BCA, every job that opens, we want qualified minorities to be at least interviewed. And in Detroit, I understand Dennis Green turned it down because he knew that it was just tokenism, that they really had, they knew who they wanted, so he didn't want to go through it. The 49ers just closed a job with a young man, Dennis Erickson, from Oregon, that they had interviewed, four, or at least three African-American coordinators in the NFL. And all three did not get the job, but they go back and give it to a guy in college. Well, those are the kinds of, every time we think we're making progress, it's those kinds of things that let us know that there's still work to be done.
Well, many years ago, as I'm sure you'll know, Cincinnati just hired the defensive coordinator from the Washington team there in D.C.
Yeah, Lewis.
Absolutely. Many years ago, though, Cincinnati hired, I think he was 28-year-old David Shula, who was Coach Don Shula's son, and I think he had, I don't know how much experience, head coaching experience he had. I think he was an offensive coordinator, I think. So at this particular point in time, you see the plan that's been implemented by Johnny Cochran and others, a representative of the BCA, to be something that's encouraging, something that you think will be good for the eventual increasing in the hiring of African-American coaches?
Well, Robert, the reason I think so is because usually the first step to solving a problem or a situation is to recognize that it does exist. And I think a lot more attention, that's why I said earlier, I think the timing is getting better because attention has been brought. See, a lot of times, a long time ago, or just a few years ago, I thought a lot of blatant things were going on to kind of oppress the African-American in terms of the coaching ranks. And nobody cared. Nobody said anything about it. But I think now that with the BCA and the initiatives that's going on and the Johnny Cochran statement, see, we're letting people know that we are aware of this. It's not right, and we are voicing our opinion. And when you voice your opinion, now people must, they will look around and say, uh-oh, now I just can't do like I used to. I can't make it as blatant as I used to because there is a report card. There is a recognition that there are some things being done. So understanding that, it really makes the timing good because, even though you might not be the number one candidate, if you go in there and get that interview and just overwhelm some people and say, oh, my goodness, I didn't know this guy had this kind of talent. Who knows? I don't know if that didn't happen at Notre Dame. They really wish that they had not gone through all that embarrassment because this guy was the best guy from the beginning, but they just didn't see it. But when he got there, they said, oh, my God, this is the guy. So bringing attention to it, to me, automatically helps it.
Now, Coach Taylor, you're there at Hampton University, and you work with a crop of outstanding young African-American males who go from you and potentially to the National Football League or into business or are becoming productive citizens of their community there. I'm curious to know, what do you tell them about optimism in terms of going forth and doing great things, not necessarily on the football field?
Well, we've been here now 11 years, and we've won 8 championships. But more importantly, over 120 guys have graduated. Now, what says to me that what we are teaching here is that we're going to use athletics as a vehicle, but the real life starts after football. You know, that coming through high school, you're 18 years old, you're going to college 4 or 5 years, you're 22 or 23. The average life of a NFL guy is about 5 to 6 years. So now you've gone through all levels, and you're just 30 years old. And the life expectancy now is 75 years for African Americans. We want to talk about what about those other 45 years? That's what we prepare them for. And the ones who have left, you know, so we had a young man that played with Tampa Bay, Darian Barnes, number 30, that played in the Super Bowl this year. But more importantly, we got bank supervisors, we CEOs in construction firms and architectural firms. We got young men who are doctors who come out of this program. We got guys who are lawyers who are practicing now that came through this program. We talk about life after football. And I think that's what makes this program what it is and any successful program, because once you're doing that, you're teaching young men to be successful no matter what they do. And I always told them, don't worry about being successful on Saturday until you worry about being a champion or being successful all week. And that's what we try to get through to these guys. And luckily, they've done well, and they come back, and they talk to the guys who are here. But that's what it's all about. It's life after football that we concentrate on.
Could you share with our audience a couple of lessons that football has taught you as a human being, as a head coach?
Well, I guess the main one is that, you know, integrity. If you can do it, say yes and do it. If you can't, you know, don't say what you think somebody want to hear. You know, integrity, because your name and your word is all you have, and you must protect those. It's important as to, again, what people are saying when you are not around that's going to make the difference in your life or quality of life. And that, to me, I think, you know, again, it comes out of athletics, because when you do it the right way, you're talking about longevity. And then the other thing is just the socialism. You know, of course, we all hear about you got to have the competitive spirit, and but the socialism, understanding that you can't come through here or do this thing by yourself, the importance of, you know, bonding with your fellow man and, you know, helping wherever you can, not just yourself, but other people. Because I really think when it's all said and done, that's why the good Lord put us here, is to make a difference, to make a positive difference, not only in our own lives, but in the lives of others.
And my final question to you, Coach Taylor, is who were some of your role models?
Well, in fact, you got to go back to Eddie, number one. I just, to me, because I've talked to a lot of people about that. I've had him here on this campus a lot of times because I just wanted to be a coach because of him. You know, going back to the old days of, you know, when it wasn't even televised, it was on the radio, that I just knew that here's a guy that was really making a difference in his own little way. He was helping to shape America by putting, you know, strong young men of character and integrity. And then watching my mom and dad every day just get up and go to work, you know, understanding that if you don't mind working, you got a chance. But if you fall short of the work ethic, then, you know, life just going to be tougher. And then, you know, from a Eddie, your own high school coach and Bob Hedden, who again just gave tireless effort. I just saw the effect of good people. They just always seemed to have time for other people. They weren't selfish. For my high school coach, my junior high coach, of course, even my college coach out of Western Illinois with Daryl Mudra. That's not to me that people who took time to help other people seem to have a more of a quality life.
My guest was Joe Taylor, former head football coach of the Hampton University Pirates, a five-time Black College Football National Champion, and 2019 College Football Hall of Fame inductee. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.